If you remember, we were talking about statistics. This is the only time in the whole course that I will talk about statistics, but it's necessary because in the context of research design, you will use some kind of statistics for one single task, for the task of helping you with decision making. When you see data, I'm going to rush through the slides just to get you in the mood of what we were doing. There's a lot of uncertainty everywhere, and that includes also, of course, when you are collecting data, when you are performing experiments. I have given you an example of a data set where that has a lot of noise, and also an example from a paper that I like because it's such a well-known domain where we have no doubt, but we can imagine what somebody who has no idea about it thinks when conducting an experiment like this. And then we saw the result of the experiment that the first reaction is, of course, the experiment completely failed because that should not be happening, right? The 5 pregnancies in the control group and only 20 in the treatment group, that's looks like a failure. But this is a typical result for any experiment, at least in a sufficiently noisy domain. In engineering, when you have a lab, you can control a lot. There will be also noise, but probably a little bit less than here. But there will be also noise, so you'll be facing a similar situation. You have multiple samples, and you hope that one group is better than the other, but you will see things like that. So now what we need to do is we need to make a decision as a scientist, and that's where statistics comes in. We need to make a decision whether our hypothesis is true or false. So in that context, I was talking about statistics, telling that it's you cannot answer every question with statistics, but there are certain regularities that are captured by statistics. There are sources of uncertainty in this experiment, in any experiment, in fact. And statistics helps us in making a decision by means of a procedure known as statistical hypothesis testing, or scientific hypothesis testing. And it's just a procedure that helps you with the decision. We talked about certain features of scientific inquiry. The important ones are a sample. We are studying a sample and then want to draw conclusions from the sample about the entire population. And then we talked about sample being unbiased and other things, which I'm not going to get into them now. And in that context, I decided to talk a little bit about statistics, the only time in this course. First is that there's a lot of common sense in statistics. Sounds a little ironic, but I assure you that from a perspective of 30-something years, I definitely think that there is a lot of common sense, plus, of course, theorems, formulas, procedures, proofs, which are quite complicated. But the intuition is there always. So we talked about why statistics, of course, this is the mathematical theory of how to process uncertainty. Then a few things from statistics that are going to be useful in you when conducting experiments. First is displaying data, calculating two groups of things. One is a measure of central tendency, mean, median, mode, and other measures. There are probably more than the 4. And then the measures of spread, essentially the measures of noise, when you have multiple, when you look at one variable. By the way, the slides are, you can download the slides from my website, so no need to take notes, unless you want to, of course, it's your choice. Every statistical package will tell you about those parameters, and more, actually. So these are called moments of the distribution. In addition to mean, variance, first and second moment, there's a third moment, fourth, etc. Interesting moments are skewness, which tells you about the asymmetry of the tails of the distribution. Also interesting. I talked about distributions. There are many histograms. It's a way of getting insight into your data. I absolutely recommend, whenever you collect data, to look at the data with your naked eye, because eyes are very sensitive to all kinds of patterns. It doesn't make any sense to use statistical procedures without first looking at the data, because you may notice interesting things. So these are histograms, one way of looking at data, at one variable at a time. The important thing is that if you change the size of the beans, the histogram changes. The same idea, but with a different distribution. This is a uniform distribution. And then there are many distributions, and as in engineers, you will probably use some of these distributions because there are theoretical reasons why, in a given situation, a distribution is used. I talked about normal distribution, a very popular one, but there are others. If you are interested in wind, for example, wind speeds are log normal, that's a known fact. If you are working with queues, any type of scheduling, queuing, Poisson distribution is used there, and there are, again, theoretical reasons why this distribution is, why the data are distributed that way. The important thing about distributions is that they are a very simple way, with one or two parameters, maybe three parameters, of describing your data. The next thing is that is worth looking at when you have data is, they're called scatter plots. In Polish, it's wykres punktowy. It makes sense to look at them when you have two variables, because when you have three variables, it becomes challenging. You have three dimensions. Four variables, that's beyond our imagination. But with two variables, it's kind of very nice. Every point is one record. It's a collection of two values. One value for the x-axis, one for y-axis. The records have multiple variables, typically, and then you look at two measurements simultaneously. Now, that's an interesting type of plot, because it shows you whether there are any dependencies in the data. And human eye, again, is very sensitive. You can, without looking, you can calculate correlation, you can do regression, but actually it's a good idea to look, because when we look at these points, for example, you notice that it's actually not a line. There is some curvature to the line, and that's that may be interesting from the point of view of your work. It doesn't depart far from a line, but there is some curvature, definitely. That is more of a line with a lot of noise. When there's no dependence, you will see a cloud, just a cloud of points without any particular order in there. A correlation is, I think we went a little bit further, but not far. It's a way of capturing linear dependence by one number. It's an interesting measure, definitely summarizes with one number linear dependence, but it has done a lot of bad things in statistics. It was proposed in the late 19th century, and then the enthusiasm about this pushed away the word cause and causality from statistics, which I think was really regretful. If you have data that are distributed normally, multivariate normal distribution, there's a theorem that says that a set of variables is distributed following the multivariate normal distribution if every marginal is normal and every relationship is linear, if and only if, actually. So, and it's a very popular distribution among multiple variables, especially in social sciences, where they write equations that are all linear. In engineering, I think we are typically more sophisticated than that, but not always. Sometimes you can use linear equations. Because all relationships are linear, then it makes sense to calculate correlation between pairs of variables. So, for example, this is a fairly strong correlation, 0.7. Correlation runs from minus 1 to 1. 0 means no relationship, no linear relationship at all. you have to be careful, because if the data are not linear, then correlation can be zero, but relationship can be actually very strong. So for example, if the data are something like this, you see that there is a strong quadratic probably relationship, correlation very likely is going to be zero. Because we can imagine, how do you fit a line to this? Probably something like this or so, and then the correlation is going to be quite likely zero. So always first look at the data. Matrix of correlation is interesting. We will come back to this data set later when trying to discover causation in this data. It gives you some ideas about the strength of relationships, at least linear relationships. Of course, correlation is going to be almost never zero in practice. It's going to be a very small number. So, just because of the noise. Linear regression is trying to fit a line to points. Did I cover this or not? I'll slow down now. This is actually a real data set. What I did once, I was teaching statistics, and I asked undergraduate students, it was in US, to come one by one to the board. As you see, there were like 20-something students, and write down the length and the height of a blackboard, like this. This is a whiteboard, but I wanted them to write it in centimeters. Estimate it with their eyes, with centimeters. That was an extra difficulty, because they are not used to that measure. They use feet and yards and miles, etc. So you see there is a lot of noise in those measurements. Some of the students estimated the length of the blackboard to be around 150 centimeters, and there were students who estimated it to be 3.5 meters. That would not happen here, of course, unless I ask you to do it in inches. That might lead to some confusion. Anyway, a real data set is showing you two things, a lot of noise, of course, but also a linear relationship, almost. So students were quite consistent. If they overestimated the length in centimeters, they also overestimated the height, as you see. Very nice. So what you can do is you can perform a regression on this data set. Regression is a statistical term that means fitting a function to data. Regression can be linear, but it can be also non-linear. So if you do a regression to these data, a quadratic regression, or any polynomial, or any function, that would still be called regression. But linear regression is the most popular. You are trying to fit a line. So you fit a line. Of course, you see, you could fit that line in many ways, and mathematicians like to do it in one and only one way. And because of that, they invented a procedure, in a moment, next slide. But why do we do that? If we have a line, what we can do is, instead of keeping those points, I can answer questions like, if a student gives me length of 200 centimeters, what height will that student give me? If the data are indeed dependent linearly, I just need two parameters, equation of a line, to make that prediction. Very useful thing, especially if you want to describe some physical system, how things are dependent in that system. And that's the reason why we do regression. Of course, if we do, let's say here, quadratic regression, very likely we are going to capture something interesting physically, a quadratic relationship. Of course, there is noise around it, but the noise comes from different things like measurements, measurement error. Anyway, the method of least squares is that mathematical way of doing it in one and only one way. So there's only one line if you perform linear regression. What they do is, if you can imagine, drawing a line perpendicular to the x-axis from every point to this line that you are trying to fit. And now you are wiggling that line and picking a line that will minimize the sum of squares of distances. There's a proof that you can kind of intuitively imagine that there's only one line like this, But there's also, of course, proof that there exists only one line that minimizes that sum of squares. So you are trying to find a line that kind of, you know, overall minimizes those departures from the line. And that's a method of least squares regression. The funny thing is, and I never really understood the intuition behind it, but I think it's a negative side effect of the procedure, is that if you try to do it the other way, then you are minimizing these distances, squares of these distances. And the two lines are different. That's funny, because if you have an equation of a line, y is equal to a times x plus b, then you can just transform it and express x as a function of y, just transforming the things. It's one line, the same line. But in the method of least squares regression, you have two lines. Don't ask me why. I think it's a negative side effect of that. Not what we would expect as engineers, of course. If there is a linear relationship, you want to have that relationship in this way. Just transform it and solve it for x. Here are just two examples from that data set of linear regression. You can do it in one, in two dimensions, so two variables. One variable is a function of another. As you see, these are two different regressions. You have two parameters, the slope and the displacement. And there's another thing. There is an adjusted R square that runs from 0 to 1, or 0 to 100%. And that expresses how much variance is explained by the line. The larger this number, the better. So if it's 100, then the points are probably exactly on the line. If it's 0, then you can still run regression, but it was probably a cloud that, you know, that line. Of course, there's a one line minimizing the distances, but it was a cloud. There was no relationship. 50 and 60 is actually quite a lot. I could show it in the data that it is actually quite a lot. The data are quite linearly dependent. So these are essentially the sum of squares, but normalized to the interval between 0 and 1. You can do it in multiple dimensions. So here is one variable as a function of two variables. So the equation is still linear, but it's an equation of a plane in three dimensions. You start realizing how big of an approximation it is when you do linear regression, right? Will those points really be on a plane? Quite unlikely, right? But you can still do it. Actually, quite a good R-square, good explanation of the relationship. Time series, we will not talk about this at all, but some data look like this. If you are observing any physical system, you can draw values as a function of time. A good example of a time series is the Stokes measurements, like exchange, like price of IBM stock as a function of time. Very good time series. Outliers, another thing, is whenever you do measurements, perform an experiment, what could happen is some of your subjects, people, animals, or types of concrete, or whatever you are doing in the physical systems, maybe data set when you are a computer scientist, they are just different. Why are they different? You know, there can be a person in an experiment or a few people who are just different. They are, I don't know, exceptionally smart or exceptionally not smart or very tall or very short. They just don't fit. They're not typical for the population. And remember, we try to make statements about populations. So we want that is disturbing us, those values. The human eye is very good in distinguishing those values, finding them. I use my eye, of course, not perfectly. I'll probably take out this one to maybe this. When you take out those outliers, then the whole thing is cleaner. What we typically do is we take them out, the outliers. In an experiment, you just take them out, don't look at them. What could happen in your lab, suppose you have a type of, again, different types of concrete. You know, somebody, maybe the cleaning person, opened the windows in the winter, disturbing the temperature in the lab, and that sample was just wrong, right? That's why you take it out. You don't want to use it because it was something went wrong, essentially, in the experiment. So that will happen. Again, there are probably formal procedures of finding outliers, but human eye is very good at that. So when you look at the data, you can find them. Now, the remainder, there's not much, actually, material, but I mentioned to you that statistics are used to make decisions, right? So helping us to decide whether our hypothesis was correct or wrong. And so now, first, at how we should make decisions, how we make decisions in practice. I bet you have made many decisions today. You decided what to eat for breakfast. You decided what to eat for lunch, because we are now in the evening, right? Maybe you drove and you had decisions to make, like you were approaching an intersection and the light just turned orange and you had to decide, gas or brake. Every decision that you make is made under uncertainty, practically every decision. There are very few decisions that you make under conditions of full certainty. So suppose you drive and approach the intersection, there's uncertainty. What if you enter the intersection, but somebody in the perpendicular street decides to enter the intersection early? There's going to be a collision. What if a person starts running or going through? Maybe you will hit that person. What if there's a police person hidden somewhere, you don't see them? You will get a few points and maybe a big fine for them. So these are the consequences. Other consequences are if you stop, for example, you may be late for a lecture, right? Or for a meeting. So there are always consequences. What consequences do we have when we are scientists? Actually, I have them listed, so let's wait for that too. Because as a scientist, when you decide whether or not to accept the hypothesis or to reject it, you also have to face consequences of being right and wrong. No matter what you do, you can be right or wrong. That's always the case when you have uncertainty. You decide what to eat for breakfast. The consequences are maybe the health of your heart. If it's a fat breakfast, maybe it's your weight, you know. You don't want to be too heavy, right? Things like that. So now we will talk about how we make decisions, how we would like to make decisions, and see how statistics helps us with that. So, of course, decision-making is such an important thing that there is a whole branch of mathematics called decision theory. It's actually part of, or very close to game theory, originated in early 20th century. Two people, John von Neumann, a mathematician, and Oscar Morgenstern, an economist, they developed decision theory. They did something actually brilliant. They showed how to measure utility. Utility is a mathematical concept of how good something is and how bad something is. Until early 20th century, we didn't know how to do it. There were some discussions of that. There were some proposals, but in economics, which is a discipline where we make a lot of decisions, actually they didn't have a quantitative utility, and most of the arguments were very qualitative. Like, I don't know if you had economics, maybe elements of it. If you remember, in economics, in the courses, we talk about supply and demand, two curves, and then we say, okay, what if we introduce taxes? Then the demand curve goes down, I think. A qualitative argument about the new equilibrium. A lot of arguments in economics are qualitative because it was developed before decision theory, they didn't know how to measure things. In any case, probability in decision theory is used to capture uncertainty, and then utility captures preferences. We are not going to do that in the fine details, but just to for you to realize what is happening. The decisions that you make, you can measure uncertainty, probability that somebody will get from the road on the intersection, probability that there is a police person there somewhere, and then the consequences. Consequences of killing somebody, of damaging the car, of getting 3 points on your driving record and paying whatever, 500 zloty fine. So these are all consequences. And then the question, of course, is how can you bring them to a common denominator? The money that you pay, the points, the being late for lectures, for a meeting, etc. This would be measured by utility. Again, we're not going to do that, but there's a way of actually measuring them on a common denominator. So now, there is a well-known thing that's actually a philosophy mainly. Around those times, many people still called themselves philosophers. Blaise Pascal, well known for some things. You probably heard the name. Physics, pressure, Pascal's. He was the guy who actually showed that there is atmospheric pressure. He was a very sickly person, so I understand that his brother-in-law has run up the mountain with a barometer to show that there is a difference between the bottom of the mountain and the top of the mountain, level of mercury. But he has shown, demonstrated that there is barometric pressure. Another thing is combinatorics, Pascal's triangle, brilliant contributions. A very interesting person, a brilliant child. At the age of 6 or 7, he was discussing things in geometry with mathematicians in Paris. His father has forbidden him because he was worried about his development. But then he became more lenient at the age of, I think, 12, where he allowed him to do that. When he was a teenager, I think 18 or so, he suffered a sudden conversion. He converted. There was an accident of his father. I think his mother was dead by that time. The father almost drowned because the carriage fell into the river Seine in Paris, and then he suddenly realized how worthless everything is in the world, including mathematics, geometry, combinatorics, physics. There's only one important thing. Religion and eternity, when he dies, what happens there? So he became very very religious, and he actually stopped all the scientific work to the probably very pity for mathematics and physics for the development of the world. But as a brilliant person who started thinking about religion, he did a lot of interesting things. One of the things is there was a schism in France at that time, which that he destroyed anonymously. He was writing letters to the local newspaper and discussing theological things with that with the people who were followers of that schism. He destroyed them. Everybody knew it was a brilliant brain. They didn't know it was Pascal. You can find it as a book now, I think, Letters from the Province, it's called. Another piece of work that he produced at that time, that just two pieces, I think it's called Pensées, which is Reflections in Polish, in English. In that, he proposes an argument to convince people to believe in God. The reason why I'm showing it is not that I want to convince you or let Pascal convince you. No, there's actually a different reason. This argument was really very influential in the development of decision theory and shows us in a somewhat funny way decision-making. A very simple example, very simple decision, which is believe in God or doubt, he calls it, which is, behave as as if you don't believe in God. And then the actual state of the world, God exists and doesn't. That's the uncertainty. That's the fundamental uncertainty. We don't know if God exists or not. It's often a matter of belief. Right? So he said he didn't draw those pictures because at that time people were not drawing too much. They were just, you know, there was a narrative in the papers. But this is what people usually draw. You can probably find it on Wikipedia. So if you believe and God exists, wonderful. You go to heaven forever. You are saved. Eternal salvation. Very good. If you believe and God doesn't exist, well, you know, you forego some of the earthly pleasures. You don't, I don't know, smoke. You don't drink too much. You don't commit adultery. Just, you know, you lead life that some people would consider a little boring. But he says, well, these are just small things that your life passes. It's very small. And then if you doubt and God exists, well, that's not very good, right? If God does not exist, you enjoy some of those earthly pleasures during your lifetime. This is all the argument of Pascal. And there is another formalism that is used in decision theory, actually decision analysis, maybe even in theory, but because I think for Neumann and Morgenstern, we're probably drawing things like that in the game trees. So this is the decision, this is the uncertainty, and these are the outcomes. This is a formalism used in decision analysis. And then Pascal, of course, brilliant mathematician, he calculated the expected utility, expected value of believing, saying if the probability of existence of God is P, then we have P times infinity, because that's eternal salvation that lasts forever. It is infinitely good, plus 1 minus p, probability that God doesn't exist, times minus epsilon. You do sacrifice some things that you could enjoy otherwise. And if you don't believe, then of course p times minus infinity, very bad, plus some epsilon times 1 minus p. And of course, you remember enough mathematics to see that this is infinity versus minus infinity. That was his argument. The important thing is the qualitative way he approached it. You see, he calculated the expected value, acknowledging that, yes, there is uncertainty. We don't know for sure. And then we essentially, this is the way we do it. And I suspect that qualitatively, every decision that we make requires some information about the probability of those uncertain things, like the probability that there is a police person at the intersection, that there is going to be somebody walking that you may hit, etc. You do consider that. Before you buy a lottery ticket, you'd like to know what the probability is of winning and also the amount that you can win, right? Normally, maybe you don't buy tickets, but if there is a big reward, you may consider it in order to calculate the expected gain, whatever you do. And that thing also, you would want to do as a scientist when you are facing a hypothesis. What would you like to know? Well, you would like to know the probability that your hypothesis is true. It's exactly the same structure as Pascal's wager. We have something that precedes the decision. These are the observed data. Remember the table I showed you. And now you are declaring as a scientist, hereby I declare that my H0 is false, or it's true. That's what people expect you to do. H0, you remember, no relationship between sexual intercourse and pregnancy. H1, yes, there is a relationship. If you want to make a decision this way, you know the consequences. If you accept H0, so you say there's no relationship, and this is indeed true, then nice, you are no change. You are essentially confirming what we think. Yes. If you say H1, but H0 is true, that's bad because you are bold and daring, you are telling to people, well, have intercourse to get pregnant, and people are going to be wasting their time having sex and no effect, right? On the other hand, if you say, okay, no relationship, you tell people, no relationship, you can have sex and you will never get pregnant, well, some people will get pregnant, not wanting to get pregnant. And then here, let's see, when H1 is true, new result, yes? So people realize, oh, I wanted to have children, and this is a good way of having children. Of course, in every situation that you are facing, it's not going to be as drastic as in Pascal's wager or in this example, but again, as a scientist, you need to make a decision under uncertainty, and you will be facing consequences of that decision. Of course, to you, the consequences are going to be somebody will tell you you are wrong. That's not very nice, of course, telling you that you are wrong in your claims as a scientist. But also you will do some good or bad things to science, and you need to think about this. In order to make a decision, you would ideally want to know the probability that the hypothesis is true after the experiment. And that's one thing you would like to know. If you want to do it, I'm not expecting you to follow this. It's just enough to say that I'm using Bayes' theorem because I want to calculate the probability of H0, my null hypothesis, given the data that I've seen. I use Bayes' theorem, and then I transform it in such a way that I name alpha to be the probability of data given H0. That's alpha. And then beta is probability of data. Probability of data given H1, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. In any case, the important thing in this transformation is that, look, we need probability of H0 a priori. So before I start the experiment, I need to have a probability of that hypothesis being true. Then I observe my data, and I change my opinion after seeing the data. And now, this is where the classical statistics and common sense part. We would love to know the probability of H0, and then we can make a decision. But statistics, classical statistics, unfortunately says, well, sorry, but where do you take this probability of H0? Not out of your nose, right? Something that we cannot get. So they are saying, okay, we cannot get this, so let's do something else. Very interesting argument. I cannot, I cannot eat dinner, so let me go and dance. Similar argument. So what do they do? They reject this approach, the approach that I called the common sense. You know, this is the way you would want to do it. They reject it and say, let's do something else. So what else is it? I'm going to transform that example experiment a little bit. Actually, we can even talk about the number of people getting pregnant, number of women getting pregnant in the control group. Suppose that this is the distribution, this is the mean number of pregnancies. Suppose I conduct this experiment many times, and the mean number of pregnancies is around 20. So this is my population in my experiment, and the mean is around 20. So now the classical statisticians are saying, let's look at the other group, and let's look at the number of pregnancies in the other group. If that number is too far, if it's far from mu zero, then it's surprising. Why in that group, the other group, the celibacy group, why were there only 5 pregnancies? That's surprising. And they are saying, if it's surprising enough, then we reject the assumption that there was no relationship. If there was no relationship, then both groups should be identical, right? The number of pregnancies in both groups should be identical. But it's never going to be identical, of course. These are people, right? The two groups are going to be always different. Let's say this is 19 and this is 20, right? Or 21, 19. Small differences are always going to be there. By the way, the distribution is normal, because if we talk about mean, a mean of something, means are distributed normally, because means are sums of values divided by n. Sums are distributed normally. So means are normal. So they are looking at surprise. Let's look at the other group and the mean in the other group. If that mean is close to mu zero, then we say, okay, the groups are probably differing just, you know, a little bit randomly. If it's far, then it's surprising, and we say, well, H0 is probably false. The question, of course, that you ask in your mind is, how far should it be from mu zero to declare that the other group must be different, to declare that I'm surprised with that result? So how far would it be? They asked that question to the guy, the statistician who designed that procedure, Ronald Fisher, and he said, smoking a pipe, that's the way I imagine him, yeah, I think that like 1 in 20 would be a sufficient measure of surprise to me. 1 in 20, it's 5%. You know, this is the alpha level that people are using, have been using since in the experiments. So, again, you have an experiment, you assume no relationship, and if you notice that there are differences between the two groups, and the difference is large enough to be surprising, then you say, no, I was probably wrong assuming that there was no relationship. That's the procedure. And how far you have to be here, that is determined by the alpha level. The alpha level of 0.05 is pulled out of Ronald Fisher's nose, essentially. You don't have to use 0.05, in fact, because it's pulled out of the nose, you can use anything. In fact, in medicine, they use 1 in 100. Why do they use 1 in 100? They want to be more conservative. If you propose a new treatment, if you propose a new theory in medicine, then you want to be conservative. There's a saying in English, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Two errors in that statement, but that's the way they say it. If it's not broken, don't touch it, don't fix it. And then you're conservative. So in medicine, you want to be conservative. Therefore, you want to be really surprised in order to change your mind. Yes? That's the reason. 0.05, 1 in 20 is just a customary number. So essentially, if you look at the normal distribution, 95% of the area under the curve, that determines the area where you will not be surprised. So if the value is within that range, then you say, ah, could happen by chance. If it falls outside of that range, then you say, oh, that's surprising enough. And that border here is, as I said, magic. Really no grounds except for saying, well, 1 in 20 is a good measure of surprise. So that's the way it works. Of course, we are not talking about any particular statistical procedures, but every statistical package will take a collection of data from you, and if you know which test to use, it will give you the p-value, that value, the p. If it's smaller than 0.05, you reject the hypothesis. It's bigger than k. Does it make sense? You may have seen that already, but it's good to see it again. Of course, there are risks. You can make an error, but you knew it already. Every time you make a decision, your decision can be wrong. Yes, you can make an error. You can suffer because of that. So in science, I guess, you need to consider consequences of that. Depending on the on the consequences, you can change that alpha value, that threshold. As I said, in medicine, it's usually 1 in 100. But what if you are working on a cure for AIDS? People are dying as you speak, yes? So maybe you want to be less conservative, and even though the p-value is, let's say, 1 in 10, you still want to try out that medicine. Again, you are to some degree free. What they expect from you is when you publish a paper to report the p-value and to reject or accept the hypothesis. But in practice you can, because that thing is really like pulled out of the nose, you can depart from that. Of course, explaining what you're doing. You cannot perform classical hypothesis testing many, many times because the probability of being wrong, if you reject H0, is 5% at alpha equal to 0.05. If you perform it 100 times, you can expect 5 times to be actually wrongly rejected. So some people take a big data set with many variables, and they are trying, you know, is this dependent, are the means different, etc. And if it comes out different, they say, oh, I discovered something. That's a bad procedure. You cannot do that because you can expect some of the tests to be essentially wrongly rejecting H0. This is a joke. Many, many tests, and then you realize, oh, green jelly beans are related to acne. Acne is the thrombogenic. Which test to use? Again, this is not a course about this. Statistics probably what was teaching you. And even then, when you do anything in practice, it's a good idea to actually talk to a statistician or somebody who has done it before. Statisticians will be able to tell you whether your assumptions are correct or not. Is it a t-test or z-test? T-test is when the distribution is normal. So when the number of measurements is typically, the threshold is around 30. If you have more than 30 measurements, they say it's normal, the mean distribution of the mean, you use t-test. If it's fewer than 30, then it's a very similar distribution, but it's called the student t-distribution, and then you use the t-test. And for every situation, there is some classical statistical procedure that allows you to make a decision. There's an anecdote. One of my advisors, Herb Simon, there's an anecdote going about him at Carnegie Mellon. He ran downstairs from the second floor from psychology to the statistics department and asked the colleagues, hey guys, tell me which procedure I should use in this case, but please give me the procedure that is the easiest to reject H0. Of course, that's not a good thing to do. You shouldn't be doing that. But the reason why he did that, and he said them, because the stupid reviewer wants me to do a classical hypothesis testing, which doesn't make any sense in this case. In fact, there are cases where the classical hypothesis testing just doesn't make any sense. There are papers about this. There are critics of that procedure. So he knew he wasn't doing the right thing, but he knew that a classical test didn't make any sense. He wanted just a test to satisfy the reviewer. Stupid reviewer. So that's the last slide already. We'll talk about a lot of these things. Scientific method. Sometimes people think that these statistical tests, the statistics, are really part of that. I don't think so. Because that will change. Bayesian statistics offers a different way of testing hypotheses, but it's still developing. They're still not as accepted, not as developed as the classical tests. The empirical work that we are going to talk about in this class, that we are talking about in this class, it's more an outlook. It's really looking at the situation, designing an experiment, an architecture of an experiment, performing the experiment, collecting the data, and then making a decision. What procedure you use to make a decision, that's a secondary issue. And you should never feel a slave of the statistical procedure. Although it has to be said that you should make sure that when you use a statistical procedure, that the assumptions are satisfied, that you know which one to use. And that usually there's a small set to use. ANOVA is a very popular one. I'll talk briefly about this. And t-test is a very popular one. When you have a small number of data points, usually these are the tests. And you compare the means, like mean strength of your new type of concrete, and then you have the sample of traditional concrete and the new one. You compare the mean strength needed to break it, for example. T-test. Unless you have more than 30 measurements, then you can use Z-test also. So it's actually simple. Good. An important thing that you will notice in the rest of the meetings is that in science, there is common sense. Of course, don't make a mistake. Like, you know, you've never been exposed to this, and your common sense will do all the whole job. That's quite naive to think about it. You need common sense that is well informed. But you will notice that in talking about experiments, designing experiments, we are dealing with an argument. Like in the case of this example experiment with the intercourse and pregnancy, we divide the people into two groups. We treat, we have a control group, and we are looking for a difference, right? It has to make sense, the argument. There is a long history of experimental designs that are worth mentioning. For example, you can find descriptions in the Bible. There is, I think, the time of the Babylonian slavery, when the Jews were in Babylon. There was a king who, I think, the citizens were complaining that the Jewish people were not eating some types of the meat. So I think it was Daniel, the book of Daniel. He said, okay, let's perform an experiment. King, your highness, we will have my people eat vegetarian diet, I think it was, and your people will eat whatever meat they are eating, I don't know what they were eating. And well, let's look at the effect. Will they be healthy after a while? Very old experiment. There's another more recent experiment in the history of experimentation. And there is a, you know, every nation has, may have derogatory names of other nations. Like, you know, in Polish we have names for the Germans and the Russians, our neighbors. Then in US, I think, they call the British Limeys. Did you hear this name?
Limey.
The reason for that is actually an experiment that they conducted. No, not the experiment. The reason for that is that the British Navy always had limes. Limes are limonki on board on ships, and that they started doing this after an experiment where they were sailing from England to the Americas. And one big problem on sailing ships was that people were getting scurvy, which is a disease of the gums. You start losing your teeth. And somebody had an idea that it may be because they are lacking fresh vegetables and fruits. So they did an experiment. There was one or two ships where they gave them a barrel of limes and asked them to have some lime juice on the way. And that experiment was very nice, because on the ships with limes, there was essentially zero scurvy, while there was a normal, usual number on the other ships. It was an interesting experiment. No randomization, no rigor, but simple experiment. You can perform experiments at home without the statistical and scientific rigor. In fact, I would say you are performing those experiments every day, don't you? Like, you know, you are eating different types of food. Suppose you have some, you know, you are suffering because, I don't know, maybe you are you have burps, like gases, after. You are trying different types of food, until those gases go away, right? That's experimenting, isn't it?
That's true.
Maybe not very rigorous, because maybe suppose you avoid eating pears, right? Because maybe you think the pears are doing this. And it's not a very well-controlled experiment, because maybe you didn't have gases because you have a glass of beer also. That prevented you from gases. Not a very good experiment, and you conclude it was pears, right? We will talk about different architectures of experiments and different ways of experimenting, but what I want to say is all of us experiment. In fact, if you have children, small children, or if you have observed small children, you probably notice funny behavior. When a child discovers a switch, they start pressing the switch, and see, oh, the light went on. Off, off. And they start playing with it. Adults often say, no, don't do that. Don't do that because the bulbs don't like it, actually. It will break at some point. But what the children are doing is experimenting. They're trying to see if every time they do that, the light will go on. They do a lot of things, children, and sometimes misbehaving and trying out. This is all experimentation. Of course, those architectures that they are using of experiments sometimes are not completely robust. We'll talk about this, but starting probably next week, not today. Today, what I want to do is I want to introduce to you the concept of causal graphs. Causal graphs are going to be very useful in understanding what is happening in experimentation, and they're going to make it easier for you to think about experiments, but also they're going to be useful in at least one class that we will have, a class that focuses on causal discovery. So the next block are causal graphs. We're not going to finish it today, but I'm going to start this. So causal graphs. The thing is causality and probability. I mentioned to you in the context of correlation that an unfortunate thing happened in statistics in the end of 19th century. The word cause got pushed away from statistics. If you remember the textbooks that you were using, they don't talk about causality at all. Maybe there is a statement, correlation does not mean causation. You remember that statement? They are warning you that if you see correlation, it does not mean causation. And there is really no mention of that word in the rest of the book. Although that has changed, it is changing. In 1990s, I already saw a couple of statistics books that had reference to causation. And they talked about causation, that there was actually a section or a chapter on that. So we are going to talk about this in the context of research design. The goal of an experiment very often is establishing causation. I'm giving this example of concrete and different types of concrete. Anybody who is from the civil engineering working on concrete? You are.
Not on concrete.
I hope I'm not saying silly things, but actually I had a student last year who was doing experiments on that, different types of concrete with different mixtures, and he was trying to find a way of producing a concrete that is stronger or has better properties, like more robustness, strength, whatever, right? So I'm going to use that example a lot just as an example. So if you are doing that, for example, then you want to establish that adding a certain additive to the concrete makes it stronger. That's a causal language, yes? That mixture causes the concrete to be stronger. Intercourse pregnancy, again, causation. Smoking, lung cancer, causation. Cholesterol, heart disease, causation. Drinking some wine, heart disease, again, causation. When you read newspapers, when you receive information about all kinds of medical things, they all refer to causation. When you read things, you read in a newspaper, for example, that 93% of successful people had pets as children. What do you think about? Well, running to a pet store to buy a dog for your child, yes? Assuming that having a pet causes people to be successful in life. Yes? Can be very false, by the way, but what I want to say is that very often we think in causal terms. Why? Because it's so important. Understanding the world in causal terms is absolutely crucial. It is crucial. I know, I learned it. If I come to you and I insult you, you will hit me maybe in my face, right? That's common. I learned it in the past. That's why I don't do it, because I understand that it's a very, very risky thing to do. I understand that certain techniques of teaching cause the students to learn more. That's why I'm using them. A child experiments because the child wants to learn the causal structure. Without causation, we will be completely lost. Smoking causes cancer, so I don't smoke because I don't want to have cancer. Smoking causes pleasure. Well, that would be nice, but I'm weighing the consequences and the temporary things. So causal understanding is absolutely fundamental. When they pushed away causation from statistics, they tried to push it away from the whole science, and until 1920s. In 1920s, philosophers and physicists absolutely acknowledge the fundamental role that causality is playing in physics. It is just a very important concept. Understanding of the world is true when it's causal, when you understand the causes, what is the cause, what is the effect. So now, when we conduct experiments, we want to establish causation because we want to learn the world. It's very important to understand the relationship between causation and statistics, probability. Because we are going to observe, record data, measure things, and we want to somehow tie the noise and the relationships to the causal structure. It's actually very simple. When there is a causal structure, then the causal structure results in dependencies. For example, flu causes fever. What does it mean, causes? Well, if you have flu, then the probability of fever is going to be higher than when you don't have flu. So, in that sense, flu will impact the variable fever. Probabilistically, because flu is not sufficient to cause fever. Very rarely, causes are sufficient to cause their effects. Very rarely. Well, there are some causes that are sufficient, like cutting somebody's head off using guillotine will probably make them dead, right? That's quite sufficient. But otherwise, flu is definitely not sufficient to have fever. And also, it's not necessary, because you can have fever in other ways than flu. But there is a relationship for sure. In fact, we understand it. Flu, we have viruses in the body. The body starts reacting to viruses, and then raised temperature is, in fact, a body defense that helps the body to fight with the viruses. I hope I'm not saying things that are wrong, but we have a causal understanding of it. So causal connections result in probabilistic dependencies. Very simple thing. And what I will do now is I will play a little bit with software.
How are we doing with time?
We still have 20 minutes. So see where that file is. I have a few examples of causation. What a pity, I don't have it right here, so let me have to go somewhere else. Maybe to another... Here, I will have one. Oh, I'm sorry for being unprepared, so let's go somewhere else. I should have it here. So what I will be doing is I will be showing you a number of causal graphs, and I will be playing with these graphs to show you dependencies. I'm going to explain you three different consequences that causation has on dependencies. Just three rules, very, very few. The first two rules scientists have known for centuries. They've been using them. In fact, I bet that you have been using these rules. The first rule is that if you have a causal chain, like flu causes fever, and fever causes shivering, then everything on this causal chain is going to be dependent on one another. What does it mean? Well, if you know that somebody has flu, then you will know that that person has higher probability of fever and also danger that there can be shivering if the fever is high enough. In fact, you can see it in the software when I observe flu. I'm double-clicking on this. You see that the probabilities here are also changing. That dependence works in both directions. If I observe somebody shivering, I wonder, maybe that person has fever. And maybe that's flu, maybe something else, of course, but maybe flu. So a chain of things makes things dependent. The same when I observe fever, that impacts the probability of flu and also probability of shivering. So connections, directed connections, work in both directions, of course, make things dependent. That's the first rule. Very, very easy to remember to realize. I don't have a mouse, so that's why. There is a strong dependence, strong correlation between the consumption of ice cream and drownings. So when you hear or read in a newspaper that many people drowned today, you can safely assume that a lot of ice cream was consumed on that day. The same the other way. If you hear that a lot of ice cream was consumed, you can also infer that there were more drownings. What is happening here? This is probably the causal graph that is explaining that. We have a common cause, outside temperature. When it's hot, people tend to cool down by eating ice cream. So outside temperature, when it's high, when it's warm, people eat a lot of ice cream. When it's cold, people eat little ice cream. So you see there's a chain, so these two are dependent. But there's also another chain here coming from this common cause. When it's warm, people tend to swim outdoors, and they swim in various places. Some of them are not guarded. They get in trouble, and then some of them will drown. When it's cold, fewer people swim outdoors, and also fewer people will drown. When we don't observe this common cause, it conducts dependence. A lot of ice cream, look, the drownings go up. The other way too, drownings, ice cream consumption. So the second rule is that common causes result in dependencies. Another funny example, there's a strong correlation between the shoe size or foot size and the ability to read. Did you know that? Very strong correlation. Again, common cause, age. Small children, babies, have feet like this. They cannot read, they cannot even speak. Yes. as they grow, the field get bigger with age, the age is a common cause, they can also, they learn reading also. That's why the correlation. You must have known this because that's a fundamental thing in observing correlations and saying, okay, this is probably because of the common cause. So this has been known for ages. A little bit of a few twists on that. I'm putting this as a joke, really. They say that it's good to have a little bit of wine every day. Not much, but a little bit. It's good for your heart. If you don't drink, you have a higher chance of heart disease than when you drink a little bit. What is happening here? I suspect that this is probably a causal link. There were some experiments in the laboratory where they managed to get some fat off blood vessels with wine. It's red wine, not white. But this is meant to be a joke. Maybe this correlation is just because of a common cause that I called here life enjoyment. What do I mean by that? You know, if you enjoy life, you come back home, you are home at 5:15 or 5:30, you don't stay at work too long, you hug your significant other, you cook together dinner, you tell about things that happened at work, and while cooking already, you pour some wine, right? Because you're not going to work in the evening. Who would work in the evening? Yes? So that enjoying life, of course, in a way makes you drink some wine, but also makes your heart healthier. You enjoy life, you are not very stressed, right? Stress, we know, is a factor in many diseases, among them heart disease. So you enjoy life, both of them become more probable. You don't, both of them not. And the correlation that you saw is explained perfectly by just common cause. I do think that this is working in reality, but probably there's a link that is direct here also. Influence of alcohol on heart disease. So you see that whenever I deal with a situation, what I can do is I can start explaining that situation in words, but I can also do it in terms of graphs. What is happening? How can I explain the observed correlation dependencies? A very important idea that I will come back to on slides is that causal graphs are subjective. Is it scary to have something subjective in science? Sounds scary, but I would say that it's subjective, but not more subjective than science itself. Because when you are a scientist, you subjectively decide what to look at, which variables to consider. Isn't that a subjective decision? Why did the person studying concrete, why did he or she choose that compound to mix with concrete? Another thing that you do subjectively is you choose which variables to look at, which variables to measure. You choose it. You choose also the granularity. See, I called it drinks, abstains, but it could be the amount of alcohol in cubic centimeters, for example, to be a continuous variable. I decided it to be binary. So these are subjective decisions, and I decided the whole world is connected through a causal graph. Everything that we do now has probably some causes in your childhood, yes? Teenage years, and everything is connected, really. You open the window, you know, there is some air that causes something and has some results in the building. But everything is connected. But you subjectively decide where to put the boundary, what to look at. Exactly the way the scientist does. So subjectivity, but not very worrying. It is not worrying me, for sure. The next thing. There is a known correlation. By the way, the numbers are mine, from my head, but the qualitative relationships are well known, so it's definitely true. In US, you can look at the statistics of surgeons. So before you undergo an operation, you can see how many operations, what percentage of operations were successful. And it turns out that the best surgeons have higher death rate than inexperienced average surgeons. Did you know that? Very counterintuitive. Best surgeons don't have the best statistics. Why is that? What is happening here?
They're taking difficult.
Yes, that's probably this is the graph. That's the way we understand it. Difficult case goes to the best surgeons. Easy cases go to average surgeons. Difficult cases have a higher death rate than easy cases. And now, when you look at surgeons only and the rate, without considering the difficulty of the case, you will notice that negative dependent correlation. There are two paths through which these two variables influence each other. There is this path and this. And this is dominating. Even though this is a path that makes top surgeons have a lower death rate than average surgeons, I made it twice as low. For easy cases, the same. So this is a path that is negative, yes? Top surgeons have lower death rate. But this path is positive and it's stronger, it's dominating this path. So things like that can happen. You see that it's useful always to try to think about the situation that you are studying. What is there? What is happening there? What is causing? And drawing something like this is better than doing nothing, because it's much harder to forget about things, but things that are there in your lap that make that may make a difference for you. The third, final rule, just three rules: a chain, common cause, and the third rule. This rule was harder to realize. I bet you are using it also daily, but it was harder to put a link between this rule and statistics. It was described only in 1970s, which is 40, 50 years ago, but by a German statistician, Nanne Vermuth, she showed that conditioning can actually induce correlation. Because let me go back briefly to that to the common causes. When you have common causes, I mentioned it to you, when you observe them, the correlation will disappear. You look at warm days, people can eat as much ice cream as they want, that will not influence drownings, yes? The same this way. So if you observe common causes, it's like observing something on a chain. If you look at people who enjoy life, in this graph, they can drink as much as they want, or they can be abstaining as much as they want. It doesn't influence heart disease. So conditioning makes things independent. That's a typical thing. But it turns out that conditioning can make things dependent. And that's that third rule. If you have causes and a common effect, the causes can be independent. The story I tell here is, this is a barometer reading. Barometric pressure, of course, influences the barometer. That's the way it's constructed. The mercury level will go up when the pressure is high and down when it's low. Another cause is, say, my brother who is joking with me, fooling around with me, putting his mouth to the pipe with mercury and blowing, making the mercury reading very high. That's a joke, yes? Another cause of the reading. And they are independent. My brother is not joking on days with high pressure. Just, you know, he chooses himself when. When the reading is high, look what happens. Maybe the barometric pressure is high. Maybe my brother was joking. I don't know yet. But now, when I hear on the radio that the barometric pressure is high, please know that that impacts my belief that the brother was joking. I'm talking about the belief, the probability as measure of belief, which is a Bayesian approach, but you will see the same thing in data. What implications it has? Very important implications in practice, that third rule. Let me just show you another example first. Here's another example. Just another example for you to feel that rule. Four different causes of problems in marriages. Probably there are more causes than the four, but I'm modeling four here. So anything, addiction to video games, to cigarettes, to drugs, whatever, is surely going to cause marital problems. Unfaithfulness, surely. Emotional dependence on parents, two. Drinking. In this model, they are all independent. People who are addicted are not necessarily drinking or loving their parents too much. But the moment I hear that the effect has happened, I hear that John is getting a divorce. Please know that each of the causes becomes more likely. Well, something has caused that the divorce, right? Maybe none of these four, but these four are suspects. The same, of course, with diseases. A person comes to the physician with fever. The physician thinks, what happened? Flu, COVID, meningitis, lungs infected, something terrible, yes, maybe may have happened. Many causes of that fever that I observe. Now, I hear that John was drinking in the high school and during the engagement and after marriage. Please note what happens. The other causes become less likely. The same with the physician. The physician finds a plausible cause of fever, let's say observes bacteria in the lungs, which is pneumonia, then thinks that, flu and meningitis and AIDS and all kind of terrible things are less likely now, yes? Because she found a plausible explanation of the effect. We do this type of thinking all the time, I think. It's nice that it was described in statistics, and it can be theoretically nicely analyzed. You will see why I'm talking about these rules later when we talk about causal discovery. But let me give you an interesting thing that will make you realize that you will encounter this thing in the lab earlier than you think. In intensive care units, OIOM in Polish, and there is a strong correlation between heart problems and lung problems, and it's negative. So when you hear that Mr. Kowalski has problem with his heart, he's in OIOM, probably he doesn't have problems with his lung. Why is that? It has to do with the data that are biased. Biased by the way they are collected. In the population, heart problems may be independent of lung problems. If you have heart problems, however, you very quickly end up in a hospital because a problem with your heart makes you die. So they want to look at you carefully. The same with lung problems. If you stop breathing, you die. So you end up in an intensive care unit. You see, they are independent in this graph. But when I collect my data in an intensive care unit, both of them, of course, are likely because it's a special population. Now, they are dependent. Just because my data is conditioned on something, it's biased, I collected my data in the intensive care unit. Very often in your lab, you will have, you will be able to manipulate things, like change something and look at the effect. But watch out, because sometimes you may have conditions that all the variables are conforming to, and that they are specific to your setup or to your lab. So be aware of that. Or if you are analyzing data that are observable, observed, the data may be like this. They may be conditioned on an effect which makes the causes dependent. Very interesting thing happening here.
How is the time?
I'm almost out of time, so just a more complex example. We'll continue with this next week. Not through the whole class, it's going to take another half an hour maybe. Just a more complex example. You see a causal graph, two diseases damaging liver, hepatitis and liver cancer. Liver breaks off bilirubin. If it's damaged, it will the level of bilirubin will be higher, and that will cause jaundice, which is this sickly color of your skin, kind of grayish, yellowish. And if it's too high, you can even get into lethargy. You can test for hepatitis B with an antibody test. And you can see those dependencies in this graph. Antibody test is dependent on all of this. Why? Through a common cause, of course, this is influence. Common cause influences all of this because there are chains here. Liver cancer is independent still. Why? Well, there is no common cause between antibody test and liver cancer. There is no directed path, so it's still independent. You can read independence from causal graphs. You can read conditional independence too. If I condition on this, then it doesn't matter whether it was cancer or hepatitis or both of them, the probability of jaundice is not affected because increased bilirubin is all I need to know. Yes, I broke those connections. So conditioning worked here. You can play with that using the software if you want to. The software is available free of charge for academic use. We'll be using it in one more class on causal discovery. Here is where you can get it, basefusion.com. You download the academic version, which has no licensing key. You can just install it and play with it if you want to. It's good for data analysis, which you will see later in the class. Maybe the 1 minute I have left, I'll just talk a little bit about this graph, and I will finish with this slide. It's just another graph, subjective, as I said. I have drawn it, flat tire in a car, three different causes of that, glass, stones, or nails on the road can puncture the tire, four different effects, noise, steering problems, accident, bumpy feeling. Accident can cause car damage, injury to the passengers, and I added knife just as a joke to show you that it's subjective. I decided, just like a scientist, I decided to put this. I decided to have these three. I didn't put screws. Screws can be also bad, right? Or barbed wire. I decided which variables are here and how to measure them also. We'll talk about this more. I will repeat the three rules on this graph, show you some examples. And then we'll take another half an hour, and then we'll continue with other topics. Any questions? Good, so I'm out of time. Thank you very much. I should check the presents.